This is going to be actually all global rigid N equal 2 supersymmetric backgrounds. There are going to be some subtleties that I'll get into as we progress. So let me begin by giving some motivation. Recently, there's been a lot of work. Probably don't need to give this motivation so much here, but there's been a lot of work about exploiting supersymmetry on curved manifolds in the past 5 to 10 years. In a certain sense, this started with, in many ways, a Peshtoon's paper calculating absorbables for N equal 4 super Yang mills on the four sphere. There were a number of other papers, for example, in three dimensions, a paper by Kapustin, Willett, and Yakov, calculating partition functions for various N equal 2 theories on three spheres as tests of various dualities. Other papers by Jafaris, Haman Hosamishi and Lee, Mamori Yokoyama, Rommelsberger, et cetera, computing various indices for supersymmetric theories. But you could, after seeing a lot of these papers, you know, they dealt with things like three spheres, four spheres, et cetera. You could find yourself asking the question, how do you put a known supersymmetric field theory on a curved manifold in the first place? Because that's what you need to actually begin the procedure of calculating anything interesting. Until about 4 years ago, for your various manifolds, your S4s, your S3s, et cetera, this was always done piecemeal theory by theory. You figure out iteratively what terms you need to add to the supersymmetry transformations and the actions so that everything was consistent under the new supersymmetry transformations. But about 4 years ago, Festucci and Seiberg gave a systematic scheme for how to do this, and their idea was to derive rigid supersymmetry from a supergravity theory. And I'll review that in a few slides, in a few slides from now. After that, there was a bit of sort of a cottage industry of characterizing rigid manifolds with some amount of supersymmetry. For example, 4D N equal 1 theories have been more or less put to bed by a large number of authors. Two of the major references I put here, but there are quite a number. I could probably fill this slide with references on various aspects of 4D N equal 1. This paper by Dumitrescu, Festucci, and Seiberg classified all possible Euclidean theories with essentially any number of supercharges. They looked at one supercharge, they looked at two supercharges with both same and opposite chirality, went all the way up to four supercharges, which was in the original paper by Festucci and Seiberg, more or less. And there's this other paper by Cassani, Claramatelli, Tomasiello, and Zaffaroni, which basically did the Lorentzian story. But there hasn't been a lot of work on 4D N equal 2, which is kind of interesting because N equal 2 theories have a lot of interesting features, and there's, in principle, more SUSY to exploit. When we started this project, there really had just been one or two papers that really dealt with N equal 2, and they just looked at classifications of backgrounds with one supercharge. And you get a very weak condition that there's a conformal killing vector. There's a paper by Clara Zaffaroni that did this, and then a preceding paper by Gupta and Murthy that did this indirectly in the context of doing localization in supergravity. We decided that we wanted to do the opposite extreme from this. Instead of asking, what about the conditions for one supercharge, which these guys looked at, we asked, what about if we keep all eight? So in particular, we decided to answer the following two questions. First, what are all the curved backgrounds that are consistent with full rigid N equal 2 SUSY? That means keeping all eight supercharges. And second, what are all the rigid actions for vector multiplets and hypermultiplets that are allowed in these backgrounds? This is my outline, obviously. I'm going to begin by reviewing some stuff about rigid supergravity and superspace ingredients that are going to go into the analysis. It turns out this analysis leads to, very naturally, to a discussion of supercoset spaces, which actually allow us to characterize these backgrounds very, very easily. And finally, time permitting, I hope, I'll tell you about how to calculate all the matter actions for vector multiplets and hypermultiplets in these rigid backgrounds. If you have any questions, please stop me. So let's go back and recall what Festucci and Seiberg taught us. They said that a rigid supersymmetry coupled to matter action, you should always think of it as a coupled matter supergravity action with supergravity fixed as a background. Now the important idea here is this: the supergravity is a background. The metric does not solve Einstein's equations. It's just a metric that you plug in. And since it's a non-dynamical metric, that means that the multiplet that it's a part of has to be an off-shell multiplet. meaning you have to keep the auxiliary fields in that multiplet. And those auxiliary fields are just going to be, like the metric, set to some fixed value that's consistent with the supersymmetry. And so the auxiliary fields play a very important role in this analysis. You can't discard them. You don't set them equal to their equations of motion. They're just a part of the theory, and they're responsible for giving the deformations of the Susi algebra. Of course, not just any rigid manifold emits Susi. Having some rigid supersymmetry means you're finding a solution of the supergravity Killing spinner equation. The variation of the gravitino is the derivative of your Killing spinner parameter, plus a bunch of terms involving auxiliary fields. I'm implicitly working with Poincaré supergravity here. So generically, when you solve this equation, what you're going to get is that the Killing spinner is equal to some dressing factor, which I called A of X there, which has spinner and R symmetry indices, which I've suppressed, multiplying some constant spinner epsilon. And the number of constants epsilon correspond to the number of supercharges that I have in my theory. Of course, I should mention there's a nice paper by Lou Pope and Rumfeld that, not in the supergravity context, but just looking at general solutions for these things in terms of spheres and ADS spaces and hyperboloids. And they found exactly the structure. Yeah, so the idea is that there is some universal form of A, and you have some number of linearly independent epsilons. Basically, the A is the non-trivial thing that satisfies this equation, and the A, the epsilon, is just something you plug in. So basically, the fact that only some epsilons are allowed are basically the statement that A satisfies this equation only if you put a certain projector on the right-hand side of it. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the idea is you're finding sort of some universal A. Yeah. So I want to make two observations about this. The first observation is a very trivial one. The second one is actually slightly non-trivial. So the first observation is that the number of solutions, I already said this, the number of different solutions epsilon is what I mean by the number of rigid supercharges. And if you require more supercharges for a given theory, you're going to get stronger conditions. And that should more or less be obvious, because you're starting with a single equation which has implicitly built into it stuff about the manifold in the spin connection and also stuff about the auxiliary fields. And as you require more and more supercharges, you're imposing more and more restrictions on it. So that I think is obvious. But what is less obvious is that the choice of n, the choice of n for the supergravity theory, and also, of course, the choice of the off-shell supergravity that I'm using determines the form of this equation. If I change n for an off-shell supergravity theory, in principle, I get different auxiliary fields. In fact, more auxiliary fields. And so increasing n actually tends to give you weaker conditions because there are more auxiliary fields. And this is perhaps counterintuitive because at least my instinct is that I think of an n equal 2 theory as a sort of a restricted version of an n equal 1 theory. So you might think that rigid backgrounds for n equal 2 theories should be a restricted subset of rigid backgrounds for n equal 1 theories. And this is not true, because the Killing spinner equation is more complicated. There's more freedom in which to move.
Well, that's like you're trying to preserve the same number of supercharges. If you say, I want to preserve 4 supercharges, mm-hmm.
Right.
But if you want to preserve all 8.
I will actually get more than n equal 1 allows. Yeah. That was actually the surprise for us. I might have thought that if I preserved all 8, I would have basically just gotten the same thing, just dressed in a funny way. But you actually get a little bit more.
I think just saying that the minimum more auxiliary fields is misleading, because you could take for the n equals 1, mm-hmm. not look at the minimal option supergravity, but the long supergravity multiple.
Right.
And then I don't think you get new background.
So for n equal 1, I agree. Yeah, for n equal 1.
It's not just a number of auxiliary fields, because
right.
you just have extra fermionic auxiliary variables.
Right.
They have their own equation.
Right.
So they can kill each other.
That's true. So I'm sort of simplifying the equation. Of course, you have to also look at all of those guys too. So so I will say that I haven't looked at the case of you know, 4 superchargers in n equal 2, but I do know for 8 superchargers in n equal 2, you get weaker conditions than 4 in n equal 1. Yeah. And so I surmise that, you know, this is sort of a generic pattern. So let me just sort of remind you of the story for n equal 1, about how the role, where these auxiliary fields come into play. So let's think about n equal 1. There are two types of minimal n equal 1 supergravity. They're called old minimal and new minimal. So old minimal, I've got my auxiliaries are a complex scalar m and a real vector g. This is the Killing-Spinner equation. I don't expect you to remember this. I'm just putting up there so you see that it generically mixes opposite chirality Killing-Spinners. For 4 supercharges, and for simplicity, I'll just assume Euclidean space here. But later on, I'll be working in Lorentzian signature. The allowed backgrounds here are R cross S3 and R cross H3, S4 and H4. For new minimal supergravity, so the difference there is I've got a U1R gauge field, which is now within the connection, or within the covariant derivative. And I've got a two-form auxiliary B, whose three-form field strength I'm calling H. Its dual is appearing there in the same slot that G appears in. And M is gone. So the equation is a bit different. And you find there, you get these backgrounds, R cross S3 and R cross H3. In fact, I think you can also do S1 cross S3 for this, but I was keeping the one-dimensional factor non-compact, just for simplicity. And you just very easily see you don't get the S4 or the H4 here. So the point of view I want to take here, knowing that different auxiliary fields lead to different results, is that instead of picking for n equal 2, some minimal version of it, I want to try to keep the most general set of auxiliary fields to try to cover all possibilities. And if I do that, that basically means I have to answer the following question. What is the most general off-shell n equal 2 supergravity theory that has the most general set of auxiliary fields? Now, that sounds perhaps like an impossible question to answer, but for n equal 2 as for n equal 1, this is actually a very tractable question to answer. And the reason is that any Poincaré supergravity theory for n equal 2 or n equal 1, you can think of, and n equal 4 also for that matter, you can think of as a conformal supergravity theory, which is unique, coupled to some multiplet which serves as your Weyl compensator, your compensator for your dilatation symmetries, and also for S supersymmetry. But that comes along for the ride. So what is conformal supergravity? Well, it's very simple. It only has 7 fields in it. I've got a graviton and a gravitino. Gravitino has an SU2 index I. Since I've got an anti-symmetric tensor for SU2, which is an invariant, I'm going to freely raise and lower SU2 indices all of the time. So if you start seeing SU2 indices going up and down, don't worry. I've got an SU2 connection for the R symmetry and a new U1 connection for the R symmetry. And then I have these auxiliary fields, a complex anti-self-dual tensor, as well as its complex conjugate. If you study conformal supergravity, this is usually called TAB. In addition, there's an auxiliary spinner chi and higher dimension real auxiliary scalar D. So I want to couple this to the most general compensator possible. Well, the longest possible compensator, the most general compensator possible, is the most general real superfield that you could possibly have in your theory. So a real unconstrained n equal 2 superfield. And this should strike you perhaps as extremely baroque, because this is a huge object. If you count the number of degrees of freedom, you're talking about 128 bosons and 128 fermions. So at first sight, this seems like an insane thing to do. But I'll tell you why at the end of the day, it is actually much simpler than it would seem at first. So what do you have? You've got the bottom component, which is a scalar. That's going to be your dilatation compensator. That gets set to 1 to fix scale symmetries. You've got a fermion, which you set to 0 to fix S supersymmetry. These are the auxiliary fields at the theta squared level, another complex anti-self-dual tensor, which I've called Y, a complex isotriplet scalar, Sij, another real vector Ga, and a real vector, which is an isotriplet, Gij. That's everything at theta squared. And there's lots of other stuff, but it turns out all that other stuff isn't going to matter.
In this language, the
Gij, And actually, in this language, there isn't a graphophoton necessarily. Right. So the thing is, the thing I'm constructing has no, it doesn't have an it doesn't have an action, if you wish.
You don't care about that.
Right. Okay. I mean, so I don't necessarily like. So for a maximal theory, I don't necessarily have to have a graphophoton. I would argue. Well, that's the minimal Poincaré supergravity multiplet. So I mean, so like what you normally call Poincaré supergravity is I choose a vector multiplet as my compensator. And the vector multiplet has
right. And then you have to choose something else on top of that. Like you need to choose the vector multiplet that gives you the graviphoton.
Right.
But then you can choose a tensor multiplet, a linear multiplet, a hyper multiplet to compensate for dilatations or whatever.
Well, the vector multiplet itself compensates for dilatations. Because you've got x and x bar. And the other one gives you consistent equations of motion. Right, but you don't necessarily have to, I mean, so you, depending on which compensator you use, you compensate for some or all of the SU2R.
Yeah.
But the real, I mean, the in a sense, the real reason that, I mean, in some sense, the necessity of that second compensator has to do with the fact that you need consistent equations of motion for the D auxiliary. Because if you don't put the second compensator in, the D equation of motion just doesn't make any sense.
But the Z transformations close nicely still, right?
Say again, I'm sorry.
The transformations would close.
Right.
I mean, we don't care about, I mean, for this exercise, right. We don't care about the action, right?
Right, exactly.
Would the transformations close properly?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, so if I just use this guy, so in other words, I didn't write this on the slide, if I use this guy, I'm just killing dilatations and SUZ, I'm keeping SU2R and U1R. So this is the most general thing you can do, keeping SU2R and U1R. And this turns out, I'm not going to prove this in this analysis, but it's actually the most general thing possible if you also want to break some of SU2R and U1R. Because the idea is, I've just assumed that I have this guy, which is killing dilatations and SUZ. I could have some other multiplet, which is responsible for killing some the SU2R or the U1R. But I don't need to make it, I don't need to assume that that is there or not there. I will get everything I need just from this. If that other multiplet is there, I'll get additional restrictions. Okay. So putting everything together, this is my what I would call general Poincaré supergravity theory, although it doesn't really have an action, although for this exercise that's not important. You've got your Fielbein, your Gravitino, your SU2 and U1R connections. This guy and the complex conjugate of that guy mixed together into a two form, which I'm going to call ZAB, which is that. And then I have these guys come down here. These are higher dimensions. These are higher theta components, if you wish. So I'm just shoving them in with all the other higher theta components. And this is only what this is all the stuff that's going to appear at theta squared. And this turns out to characterize the theory for reasons I'll describe in just a moment. By the way, the reason I'm calling this thing ZAB is if in this general Poincaré supergravity theory, I had put a complex central charge, which is permitted by the algebra, the ZAB would morally be the field strength. It would look, it would sort of appear kind of like the field strength of that central charge. Kind of. All right, so what's the killing spinner equation that I get for this? Of course, there are lots of other equations. I have to look at the variation of all of the other billion fermions I have in this theory, but I just want to start with the killing spinner equation. I'm writing it out here. I don't expect you to remember it, except just to see that all of those factors are appearing. Now, if you, all of the theta squared guys are appearing. Now, if you look at the structure of this, you've spent some time thinking about this, you can convince yourself that essentially all possible structures that I could put into that auxiliary field block for the killing spinner equation are appearing here, up to potential redefinitions of the SU2 and U1R connection. So morally, this is, in a sense, the most general n equal 2 killing spinner equation I could write down. It turns out it's extremely helpful, although not necessary, to express this in superspace. And this helps the analysis. So if you go to superspace, your delta Q operator, the thing that generates supergravity transformations, is associated with some superspace covariant derivative, d alpha I. And the algebra of the delta Qs with themselves gets mapped to an algebra of superspace covariant derivatives. And I've written it schematically here. Two light chirality guys give you Lorentz and R symmetry curvatures, whose form I don't really care about for this talk. Opposite chirality guys give you the vector derivative, as they must, because it has to match the Minkowski result. and then Lorentz and R symmetry curvatures. The important thing is at the level of this algebra, all of these Lorentz and R symmetry curvatures are built just from these guys. Now, the nice thing about thinking about this in superspace, and this is sort of where the magic happens, is that if I'm requiring a rigid supersymmetry, I actually have to leave these curvatures invariant. And if you think about this, the analogous bosonic statement, this is more or less obvious. Like if I have some vector isometry, I have some bosonic isometry of a metric. If I look at the curvature and tensor has to be invariant under that isometry. So if I'm looking at a killing spinner, which is a super isometry, the super curvature tensors must be invariant under that super isometry. So in particular, if I pick on this first curvature tensor here, and I require it to be supersymmetric, I've only written the left-handed guy here. In principle, I should also not be lazy and write the right-handed killing spinner contracted with the spinner derivative of S as well. If I require that to be zero, that's an equation that I should be able to solve if I want to characterize this superspace. Now, the thing that's magical that happens when I'm keeping all eight supercharges is that the only way to solve this equation is that that equation must be true. And the reason for that is that I'm requiring that I have eight linear, at a generic point in space-time, I have eight linearly independent killing spinners. They're contracted with something, and I'm saying that is zero. The only way for that to happen is that that something is zero. So these supercurvature tensors must actually be annihilated in superspace. What that means, well, if that's true, then certainly that statement is true. If I take the algebra of these spinner derivatives in superspace, that also must annihilate them. But this algebra is completely specified here. Well, it's specified in our paper, schematically specified here. And if you analyze that equation, that gives you a large number of integrability conditions involving all of these objects contracted in various ways and a bunch of algebraic relations between them. In particular, if you take two Ds of opposite chirality, you get a vector derivative. And so that actually tells you that essentially all of these curvatures are covariantly constant. And in fact, the conditions are consistent with taking them to be actually constant. You can fix your Lorentz and R symmetries and fix all of these curvatures to be constants. And this was first observed in superspace in a paper by Sergei Kuzhenko for N=1, and then with collaborators in a paper for 5D. And this is what actually is going to make this analysis very, very tractable. Does that make sense? OK, well, you have the algebra of the spinner derivatives. If you crank through your superspace Bianchi identities, you can work out the Riemann tensor. And I've written the Riemann tensor here in terms of these constant objects. I don't expect you to remember it, but just except for the fact that it's bilinears in all of these objects, which has to be, of course, by dimensional reasons. So in principle, we have the curvature tensor in general. We have a number of relations which I haven't written down yet. That relate all of these objects together. Essentially, the relations tell you when certain of the objects are turned on, other ones are turned off, there's certain transversality requirements, et cetera. But what we really want to know is what's the global structure of these spaces? Like, I mean, maybe I can come up with a space that has the same Riemann tensor, but I mean, is that really sufficient? I mean, how do I think about it? You know, sort of most generically. I mean, more importantly, I mean, I've written down integrability conditions for these killing spinners, but I haven't actually solved the killing spinner equation, nor have I even written down all of the equations for all the other fermions that have to be invariant. So how do I actually know that I have a full set of killing spinners? Well, the answer to this is that the fact that we have constant curvature tensors implies, essentially, that we have a super coset space. More accurately, for any superspace algebra with constant curvatures or constant supercurvatures, you can construct, very simply, a global super coset space that has the same curvatures. So the slight hole in this argument, which I alluded to at the beginning, is that it's also possible to have spaces that are discrete quotients of the spaces that I'm describing. If you introduce discrete quotients that preserve the supercharges, those spaces are allowed to. So I want to describe what all of these super coset spaces are. That's the goal. So let me just review what coset spaces are very, very quickly. So suppose I have a Lie group G, it's got some subgroup H. The coset space G mod H is a set of equivalences. G is the same thing as GH, where H is an element of H. I'm going to assume, moreover, that if I take the Lie algebras, I can decompose G into the Lie algebra of H plus the remainder set of generators K, which are not which don't close amongst themselves. So that, of course, the Lie algebra of H has to close into H because H is a subgroup. The Ks form some representation of H. And the algebra of Ks doesn't necessarily close. I make no assumptions about what the algebra of Ks is. Schematically, the coset space is generated by those Ks. So more physically, think of the Ks as momentum generators. Think of the Hs as rotation generators. What you can do is you can introduce a representative coset element, L of X, which you get by exponentiating the Ps with some coefficients, X, which are going to be your coordinates. Then the action of G on the coset space can always be written in the following way. You act with G on your coset representative by sort of the assumptions of the coset structure. That has to be equal to some other coset representative at a new point times an element of H, but that's just identified by the coset structure with L at the new point. So what G does is takes you from the point X to a new point X prime. And this works for all G and G. The reason that's useful is that the local geometry is automatically encoded in your choice of coset representative. So if you've got your coset representative, you can construct the Cartan-Mauer form, L inverse DL. That has to be, because it's differential element, it has to be an element of the Lie algebra. So I can expand it in the generators of my Lie algebra, which here I'm calling P and M for physical reasons. Coefficient of P, I can call a Fehlbein. The coefficient of M, I can call a spin connection. The reason I do that is that if I now go and construct the covariant derivative out of the Fehlbein and the spin connection, it automatically inherits the algebra that the P operators originally had. So if the Ps have an algebra with going into a P with some structure constant and an M with some structure constant, if you calculate the algebra of the covariant derivatives, in general you get a torsion in a Riemann tensor. What you find is the torsion tensor is given by that constant, and the Riemann tensor is given by that constant. So in other words, if you have these constant coefficients, you can just directly construct a space that automatically has that torsion and curvature tensor. Moreover, and this is actually the important part for us, local isometries for coset spaces, I'll get to super cosets in just a moment. Remember, my local isometries are killing vectors that have to obey the killing vector condition. Killing vectors are actually encoded algebraically in this theory. I should say some of the killing vectors are. There could actually be other killing vectors, but for us, these are the analog of this argument is going to be ironclad for the super coset case. They're encoded algebraically. So what I mean by that is if I take a generic constant element of the Lie algebra, so a constant element times P, a constant element times M, and I conjugate it with L on both sides, I expand that in the basis of the Lie algebra again, I get some C of X times P, some CAB of X times MAB. This guy, CA of X, automatically obeys the killing spinner equation, or excuse me, the killing vector equation, just as a consequence of the coset structure. That's straightforward to prove. And it's a simple algebraic exercise by just doing commutators, or using Mathematica, that this C of X is given by some matrix acting on that epsilon and some matrix acting on that lambda. And so what we've done here is we've turned a problem of solving a differential equation, that, into a problem of doing algebra, which is that. And algebra is much, much easier than solving differential equations. Now, everything I just said, absolutely nothing changes if I go back through and in front of every noun, I put the prefix super. Nothing changes. Instead of killing vectors, I'm talking about killing spinners. Instead of just Ps, I've got Ps and Qs. So super coset spaces, same thing holds. I've got a super coset representative. It's expanded in terms of Ps, Qs, and Q bars with coordinates X, theta, and theta bar. The killing spinners turn out to be very trivial to calculate. It's just like with the killing vectors. In fact, since I only cared about the killing spinners on space-time, not on this whole superspace, I'm just going to do this calculation with theta equal to 0. Turns out that's sufficient. And to calculate these killing spinners, all you do is you sandwich this general odd element of the super Lie algebra in between the coset representative. You do your algebra, you read off xi of x times q, xi bar I of x times q bar. And these guys are your killing spinners. Generically, they look like this. There's some dressing factor times the constant epsilons. We didn't invent this. This has been done before. For example, there's a nice paper by Thomas Ortin with collaborators. And this gives just a very simple algebraic procedure for constructing all the killing spinners. You don't have to solve an equation. You just do algebra. Or more accurately, again, use Mathematica to do the algebra. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. So what are the allowed spaces? In principle, we know, you know, how to calculate everything now. What are the allowed spaces? Well, let me remind you what we had. These were our background constant fields. A complex Sij, which is an isotriplet. A complex Zab. A real vector Ga, and a real vector isovector Gaij. So this was a story on a few slides ago that they're invariant under the supercharges. And so if I take the I'm opposing all eight. Right. So everything I'm doing now only holds if we're keeping all of them. You only have the super coset structure if you're keeping the maximal set for a given n. And so this is why this entire argument works. So this ZAB, just a couple comments about it. It's a complex field strength. Its exterior derivative is 0. If I had a complex central charge in the supergravity algebra, this would be its field strength. But it'd be a constant field strength. This GA, sometimes it's useful to think of it as the dual of a three-form field strength. I'll just throw that out there. Now, let's actually start using all the equations I didn't tell you. So those equations basically tell you that these constant background fields have to decompose in certain ways. Certain products of them have to vanish, which means only certain ones of them can be turned on at a time. So these are your three options. Either this guy alone, Sij, this guy alone is turned on, everything else is 0. This guy alone is turned on, and it decomposes as a product of a vector and an isovector. Those give you actually pretty generic, boring spaces. The interesting spaces you get if you keep both of these things turned on. You can have both of those be non-zero. The only constraint they have to obey is a certain transversality relation. I want to make a comment before I tell you what you get. The background fields here, they determine the R symmetries actually in two different ways. So one of them is quite obvious, which is that you know, these guys, if some of them, if they're turned on, they just obviously break some R symmetry. So the isovectors Gij and Sij, they point in some direction in isospace. So they clearly break SU2. In fact, they're going to break SU2 to an SO2 subgroup of rotations around them, if you think of them as a vector in SO3. These guys, Z and S, which are complex, if we turn those on, they're going to break the U1 R symmetry. Again, because they would otherwise rotate under U1R. Those are sort of obvious observations. The less obvious observations are that these things also generate R symmetry within the Suzy algebra. So what I mean by that is if I look at the algebra of two left-handed generators, if S is turned on, it generates a certain SU2 R symmetry transformation. This I here is my label for the SU2 R generator. And so it generates a certain SO2 R symmetry transformation. If Z is turned on, it generates all SU2 transformations within the Suzy algebra. If I look at the left and right-handed guys, if G is turned on, it generates all of the SU2. If Gij is turned on, it generates the U1R. That blackboard A is my notation for the U1R generator. So there are two different ways these things affect R symmetry. One, their VEVs obviously affect it. The other is that these things very non-trivially tell me that R symmetry is generated within the Suzy algebra. So if something is supersymmetric, it has to respect certain subsets of the R symmetry group. All right, so what are the backgrounds? I'm going to start with the Lorentzian case, because the Lorentzian case is actually a little bit more interesting. The Euclidean case is sort of comparatively less exciting. And I'm going to start with the simple cases, the cases where I don't have any mixing between things. I just have one field turned on. So the first case I can have is ADS4. That corresponds to having Sij turned on, and that gives me this supergroup, OSP2/4. The other geometries I have are two copies of R cross S3 and ADS3 cross R, as well as a plane wave, and then a space ADS2 cross S2, its certain flat limits, and another plane wave that's related to them. These two blocks of classes arise because I have two different vectors in my theory. And the vector can either be time-like, space-like, or null. And that affects whether I have an R cross S3 or an ADS3 cross R, or a plane wave.
The plane wave comes from the flat?
Yes. No, this one will not be in general. Yeah. Nor will the mixed ones on the next slide or in two slides from now. The interesting thing about these two cases is although the space-time properties are the same, the supergroups are different. So the GIJ case, space-time symmetry group here. Remember, I'm dealing with, so for this case, let me focus on the R cross S3. Let me ignore the R and just look at the S3. The space-time symmetry group is SO4, which is SU2 cross SU2. These represent two different supersymmetrizations of this supergroup. The first one basically splits the supercharges, puts half of them here and half of them here. The second case puts all of the supercharges in one of the factors. Okay? And the same holds for the ADS3 and plane wave versions, more or less. Well, for the ADS3 version, the plane wave is more complicated. The ADS2 cross S2 case, that is sourced by a single ZAB. The two sort of flat limits correspond to Z squared being purely positive or purely negative. The generic case, you can decompose Z into a piece whose square is positive and a piece whose square is negative. And this corresponds to a certain special supergroup, D2 on alpha. Okay. So these are the simple cases. Say again? Oh, I'm sorry. That's a good question. Alpha is basically the ratio of the radii of the spaces. So alpha is equals zero and alpha equal infinity are the two flat limits. Okay. Let me just say something about ADS2 cross S2 and D2 on alpha. There's a certain non-trivially spherically symmetric solution of gauge supergravity, which is ADS2 cross S2 of equal radii. This has 8 supercharges with the supergroup SU1, 1/2. That's a special case of this family I mentioned in the previous slide. This describes the near horizon geometry of an extremal BPS Reisner-Nordström black hole. And there's a whole story relating this to the attractor mechanism, which I'm not gonna go into. So you can think of the D2 on alpha as sort of generalizing this to different radii supergeometries. That's a little bit deceptive because this generic class D2 on alpha, as well as a lot of the other classes I'm mentioning, they're not actually solutions to supergravity. In fact, you can prove generically that they can't be solutions to four-dimensional supergravity. And I'll come back to that at the end. But again, we're not trying to find solutions. These are just rigid geometries. I should just mention, because it has some nice structure, the bosonic part of this algebra is SU1, 1, SU2, SU2. The Qs are in a 2, 2, 2 representation. The reason you have these three factors is the SU1, 1 is the ADS2, the SU2 is the S2, and the SU2R is the SU2R. And I should mention, this has been studied recently with various applications, including by Cedric Musema Sinamuli, who's a grad student here, I believe. Yeah. Okay, now let's think about more complicated spaces, which I haven't told you anything about yet. I want to think about deforming these spaces. So I'm going to think about turning on both G and Z. In particular, I want to talk about squashing the S3. Now, it turns out it's possible to squash the S3, but it's only possible to do it for one of these supergroups. So I remind you, I had GA and GIJ, giving R cross S3 and Lorentzian signature. These were their supergroups. If you stare at this, you can kind of see that it's not really possible to squash the S3 without breaking some of the SUSY. Because to squash the S3 means to break some of this bosonic symmetry. But if you break some of the bosonic symmetry here, you're more or less guaranteed to break some of the supercharges. That's a hand-wavy argument. You actually see this just from doing algebraic consistency. But you can just sort of see it hand-wavily. You just can't break the bosonic symmetry without killing the supercharges. Whereas here, you can actually break that SU2 because it doesn't have any supercharges. And that gives you the SU2 cross U1 version of the squashed S3. Schematically, if you think of the S3 as an S1 fibered over S2, what you're doing is you're turning on ZAB along the S3, and you're squashing the S1 fiber. So this is the metric for that. You've got your S2 factor, you've got your S1 fiber, and what you're doing is you're putting a squashing parameter in front of it. And it turns out, for reasons of SUSY, for Lorentzian signature, that's always a squashing parameter. It has to be less than 1 and greater than 0, or equal to 0. You can repeat for the space-like Gs to give deformations of ABS3 cross R, using very similar language. So what are the mixed cases, the fun cases, the stuff that we were actually really quite interested in? Well, I've already sketched for you what's happening with the S3. You turn on a Z by the transversality condition, it has to be purely spatial, squashes the S3. For the ADS3 cross R, when G is space-like, you actually have multiple options for the Z. And for the case where the Z squared is positive, you actually have even further options still. These three options give you the various sort of nice geometric warpings of ADS3. You get a time-like stretched ADS3. Again, the stretching is along the time fiber. Story is just like what I said with the S3, except you wick rotate either the fiber or the base space. You can have space-like squashed ADS3. Again, the stretching versus squashing is dictated by Lorenzi and SUSY. You can have a null warped ADS3. Again, this is preserving all eight supercharges. And then you can have some more interesting things. You can have a warped Lorentzian S3. So Lorentzian S3, what I mean by that is you take the metric I wrote on the previous slide with the S1 fibered over an S2, and you just flip the sign in front of the S1 fiber. This is kind of interesting because we just sort of discovered this because we didn't know this before. That geometry actually arises from the Taubnut solution in Lorentzian signature. If you just sort of fix it at constant radius slice, the angular coordinates and the time coordinate basically describe a Lorentzian S3 with some warping factor in front of the time coordinate. You get a Heisenberg group, which has an interpretation as a rotating relativistic fluid. I don't want to talk about that, really. And then you get, for the case where G is null, you get some nasty plane waves, and then you get a light-like version of this S3. So this is all of these cases are sort of things that you don't see in the four supercharge n equal one. Of course, you also don't see ADS2 cross S2 there. But in particular, you're allowed to squash S3s and ADS3s, which we found to be a bit of a surprise. In Euclidean signature, you can repeat the whole story. So to sort of have a little bit of control on this, we chose our 4D n equal 2 spinners to be symplectic Majorana-Weyl. Well, I learned this is not actually the most general thing I should do. I should really think about allowing completely complexified SUSY, but keeping the metric real. But to keep our analysis sort of focused, we decided to impose a reality condition. The interesting thing about that reality condition is that the left-handed and the right-handed supercharges are completely independent of each other. And so these complex fields, S and S bar, now I'm going to call them S and S tilde, because left and right-handed supercharges aren't related by complex conjugation, S and S tilde are not related by complex conjugation. And so I could have one turned on and the other one turned off. That leads me to this last case, which I'll describe in just a second. Generically, if I have everything turned on, or you know, analogs of what I had in Minkowski or in Lorentzian signature, I get spaces that are sort of obvious wick rotations, analytic continuations, what have you, of the Lorentzian cases. If S is turned on and it's S tilde, I actually can get both. You can get both S4 and H4, essentially because given S, you can take S tilde and flip its sign freely. And so that flips you from an S4 to an H4. For the two Gs, they both give me a three-dimensional space times R. One gives me an H3, the other one gives me an S3. Actually, for both of them, I believe the R can be actually compactified to an S1. For this one, I believe the S1 has no constraint on its radius. For this one, the S1 radius has to be a certain integer multiple of the scale of that G. And then you get, in the case where both Z and GA are turned on, you get various warpings. Warped S3, warped Euclidean ADS3, that's the Euclidean analog of the Lorentzian S3, Euclidean ADS3. And then we get H2 cross S2. If I allowed my supercharges to be complex, you know, obvious things could happen here. I could have S2 cross S2. I could have these guys, I could flip those, that S into an H or that H into an S, et cetera. Something that we found slightly interesting, which surprised us, although afterwards it shouldn't have, was that, again, because these guys are independent, I could have one turned on and the other one turned off. Remember the Riemann tensor. It was written as bilinears of all of these objects. If I have one of these guys turned on, but the other one turned off, they don't contribute anything to the Riemann tensor, because the Riemann tensor is built from their product. And so you actually end up with flat space. You get a Riemann tensor which vanishes. But the Suzy algebra is deformed. So you get a deformed Suzy algebra preserving all eight supercharges. This, again, is not surprising, because afterwards we realized that if I turn off S and keep part of the Z turned on, I think the anti-self-dual part of Z, that basically gives you the one full Suzy limit of the omega background. So there's a limit of the omega background where you set the two parameters equal to each other or opposite each other. I forget the convention. That gives you a background with all eight supercharges preserved. And that's one of these cases. Okay. Say again? Yeah, but all these a lot of these backgrounds do break rotational symmetry. Right. So what happens is, it is flat space. The metric is delta AB, but there is a background tensor field on this space which breaks the rotation symmetry. Yeah, but it doesn't contribute to the Riemann tensor. The Riemann tensor just is zero. So let's move on to the matter actions. This is where at least I spent most of my time. I'm going to sort of do this very, very schematically and not give you a lot of the gory details. So there are two things we can have. We can have abelian vector multiplet, or we can have vector multiplets, and I'll, for simplicity, just talk about the abelian case, although you can generalize to non-abelian. And then I'll talk about the hypers. So if the abelians, let me just really quickly remind you of the Minkowski story. In superspace, I've got this vector multiplet superfield. I'm going to call it X. These are its components, complex scalar, Gugino, field strength, auxiliary field. The guy that gives you your action is a holomorphic prepotential, f of x. You write it as a full superspace integral. You find that your x's have a target space, which is special Kähler. The Kähler potential in these conventions is given as that. You write down your action. Conventions now are that there's a negative I there. You get your scalars. You get your f squared term. You get your generalized theta angle and lots of other stuff, which I'm suppressing. And let me just mention, there's a whole story here about duality symmetries. Duality symmetries of this Minkowski model generally lie in the inhomogeneous symplectic group. So when you look at the field strengths and the dual field strengths, G, so the dual field strengths, I don't mean F tilde, I mean I take the Lagrangian, differentiate with respect to F, and then take the dual of that. That's what I'm calling G. There's a duality symmetry that preserves the equations of motion where that transforms with a symplectic matrix, a real symplectic matrix multiplying it. I say it's inhomogeneous because if I look at the scalars, xi, and the dual scalars, the derivative of the prepotential with respect to x, that transforms by Suzy with the same matrix, but it has an inhomogeneous piece, which is allowed in Minkowski, an inhomogeneous constant piece. So this is Minkowski's story. If I go to one of these rigid curved backgrounds, yeah.
There's another invariant with respect to the vector
some kind of what invariant?
Shannon Lyapunov, n equals to.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So if I couple it to hypermultiplets. You mean?
Just think of the side term, like side D.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, okay. I would think about that. Sorry. Yeah, I would think about that as, yeah, that's true. I can put that in. That in my language, I guess I would think about that as coupling to a frozen hypermultiplet. Right, but I mean, I could think about the background linear multiplet as being also a background hypermultiplet too. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I'm just trying to keep. Yeah, yeah. I can definitely do that. Yeah. So, what about if I go to a general curve background? Essentially, the superfield superspace description is in no meaningful way changed. One interesting thing you see is if that there's a U1R present, the prepotential turns out to be degree 2. It has to be superconformal. That's obvious because if you've got an R symmetry generated in the Suzy algebra, these X's have definite R weight. They have definite R symmetry weight. The R symmetry must be respected by the action because of Suzy. And so by the sort of the usual story, preserving the R symmetry ends up telling you about the dilatation symmetry because the objects you're looking at, the vector multiplets, have R symmetry and they have Weyl symmetry and they're related. The background fields, of course, do introduce new couplings in the action. Very quickly, sort of the most interesting ones, in addition to all sorts of potential terms, are that this ZAB gives you moment-like couplings. And it couples exactly as if it were a background vector multiplet. You get some couplings between Z and F and the dual of Z and F with some scalar-dependent stuff multiplying it. Rather interestingly, this GA gives you a composite B wedge F term. So remember I said you can think of the GA as a dual of a three-form field strength. If you take what you get in the action in terms of G, you replace it with the dual of H, and then you integrate by parts, you get this nice B wedge F structure, where the F is the special Kähler 2 form. And the reason I mentioned the duality transformations on the previous slide is they get a little more interesting in this model, partly because of these moment couplings. If you look at the duality transformations of the vectors, they now see the inhomogeneous part. The inhomogeneous part here, the C's get weighted by these constant Z's in this background. Now, there's a whole simple interpretation, actually, of this in terms of a frozen background vector multiplet that is generating ZAB. So if I had chosen not just a generic a generic superfield as my compensator, if I had chosen a vector multiplet as the compensator, essentially, you could rederive all of this just by interpreting this ZAB as the field strength of that vector multiplet. And so what we said earlier, you actually end up seeing that, at least for the vector multiplets, you don't see much that's different than you would have expected by choosing a simpler compensator. A couple other things that are interesting. Well, the Suzy transformations, of course, are deformed by the presence of these background objects. So the conditions you get for Suzy back are a little bit different. One of them is that the product of GAIJ at X is zero. This is actually really simple if you realize that having GAIJ means that you respect U1R symmetry. In fact, you generate a U1R symmetry in the Suzy algebra. So if you have a supersymmetric configuration, you have to have a U1R invariant configuration. So certainly, Xi must vanish in that background. Fairly boring. If you have S turned on, there's a constraint on YIJ that it's equal to this and its complex conjugate. So in Lorentzian signature, this says an ADS4. The phase of the Xi is fixed at a Suzy at a supersymmetric point. The field strength condition tells you that the field strength is related to the scalars by this ZAB. And this is basically a generalized attractor equation. If I look at the actual supergravity solution that falls into this class, that's just the usual BPS attractor equation. And this is completely straightforward to generalize to non-abelian vectors. What about hypers? I'll be very quick with this. So we generally have complex scalars, A and B, in conjugate reps. It's useful to put them together into coordinates phi m of some sigma model. The sigma model has a metric which describes a hyper-Taylor target space, which means I've got three covariantly constant integrable complex structures. Now, how we actually calculated the actions for this, let me first remind you of a story from superspace, is that there's a description of the hypermultiplets in an extended harmonic or projective superspace. The way that works very schematically is you take these fields and you group them into superfields that depend on an auxiliary S2. So in addition to your normal extra Grassmann coordinates, you add a whole new extra S2 manifold that has its own coordinates. The harmonic superspace case, the sigma model turns out to be described just like a Kähler potential describes a Kähler manifold. There's a single function which has the properties of a Hamiltonian that describes the hyper-Kähler manifold. In projective superspace, or twister space, if you wish, there's a corresponding sort of prepotential object, F, which has an interpretation of, as a canonical transformation of an underlying symplectic structure, which does the same thing for a projective superspace that this guy does in a harmonic. And in fact, these are related to each other. You can derive this thing from this thing. And you can, you know, from these actions, you can actually construct component actions. You can actually, you know, turn the crank and get all the, you know, generic supergravity couplings, etc. So in principle, yes, everything is off shell here. So the name of the game is to figure out how to eliminate all of the auxiliary fields. But what's very difficult about this is that you have an infinite number of auxiliary fields that you have to eliminate. But it turns out there are very nice ways of eliminating them, essentially having to do with the Hamiltonian structure of this system or the canonical structure of that system. So what about in the rigid curve case? Same basic procedure holds, except target space structure has additional requirements that come from the R symmetry group. So this is the result. I won't tell you how really where it comes from. If in the SUSY algebra, you don't generate any SU2 R symmetry, you don't get any restrictions on your target space. If in the if in the SUSY algebra, you generate all of the SU2 R symmetry, you actually have to have a hyperKähler cone. You end up with a conformal Killing vector on the hyperKähler manifold. If you only generate an SO2 subgroup of the SU2 R, you actually get something in between. You get a hyperKähler manifold with a special Killing vector that rotates the complex structures. Essentially, if you think of the complex structures as a vector in SO3, they get rotated around the thing that the sort of the invariant vector that describes that SO2 within SO3. You can derive these from harmonic and projective superspace, it turns out, because the prepotential H or F for harmonic or projective turns out to depend on the extra coordinates of the auxiliary S2 only in certain ways when you have certain amounts of R symmetry. And I should mention the properties of this SO2 case, I think were first noticed by Sergei Kuzhenko and I for ADS4 a few years ago, basically the same week that John Bagger and a former student of his, Xiong, did the same thing for ADS5. There's sort of a very general story for the ADS cases. Interestingly, if I have GAIJ turned on, I get a B wedge F term for the hyperKähler manifold now. The GAIJ, I sort of dualize it to its dual two form. The F that I get is the triplet of hyperKähler two forms of the hyperKähler manifold. And finally, I mentioned this, I think. This is new. I haven't mentioned this yet. If I analyze the full SUSY configurations of these spaces, you find certain things that are fairly obvious. If you have the full SU2R present, then the scalars have to lie at the origin of the hyperKähler cone. Basically, they have to be invariant under the SU2R, which sort of spins the hyperKähler cone around, so they have to be at the origin. If you have the SO2R present, there's a weird condition that you get, which we don't completely understand, which is that this special Killing vector turns out to be parallel to any gauged isometries that the space has. Those are the non-trivial SUSY configuration conditions for vacua. All right, we calculated the n equal 2 star action. Let me skip that. And let me just conclude. So we found all emphasize global rigid n equal two spaces. And we constructed all of their actions with generic generic target spaces. But there are some gaps in unanswered questions. So first thing, what I alluded to at the beginning, we assume global manifolds. But there are lots, it's very possible to have discrete quotients. My co-author pointed out to me, in particular this R cross S3, it's actually possible if you look at the S3 as the S1 fibered over the S2, the killing spinners turn out to be independent of the S1 fiber. So you can just take the S1 and you can quotient it by any, you know, ZP. And that gives you a lens space. That seems to be allowed. Another thing I sort of mentioned in passing is that it's not clear that there's a dynamical origin of these guys. We didn't care for this analysis, but it turns out that you can very generically say that only a very small subset of these solutions have, only a very small subset of these backgrounds have can be found as solutions of supergravity systems in 4D. I think that the general proof is due to these guys. But just because you can't find them from 4D doesn't mean they're unphysical. You could imagine compactifying a higher dimensional theory and getting these things out of it. So for example, this was pointed out to us by Dima Sorokin, that the theories with D21 alpha, you could potentially think of them as coming from something in 60, because in 60 you have a vacuum which has a supergroup D21 alpha in it, corresponding to ADS2 cross S2 cross S2. So if you imagine compactifying on one of the S2s, you could imagine getting some of these backgrounds out of that. Another comment is that many of these spaces involve these trivial R factors, multiplying everything, so we could very easily reduce to three dimensions. And so clearly, there are a lot of interesting 3D Euclidean or Lorentzian n equal 4 spaces that are possible, for example, with squashed S3s. What about other 3D n equal 4 spaces? That would be interesting to understand. I should mention, again, we exploited the coset structure to radically simplify everything just by just doing algebra, not solving any differential equations. So if I'd now looked at four supercharges for n equal 2, of course, that's not going to work there. You're not going to have this super coset structure. So what happens there? You know, how strict or weak are the conditions you get for four supercharges for n equal 2? Finally, just an observation. The general compensator framework doesn't seem to give new backgrounds for the case that we were looking at. It turns out everything that I got, I could have gotten by taking a vector multiplet compensator or a tensor multiplet compensator. And that's similar as the story for n equal 1 with four supercharges. Taking the most general thing possible, maybe 16 plus 16 supergravity, does not give you anything different from old minimal or new minimal. But what about for, you know, the half supercharge cases, n equal 2? Or what about looking at n equal 1 for 16 plus 16? I don't think this has been done. There was an interesting paper a couple weeks ago by Hagen Trindell about, I think what he did was he looked at effective n equal 1 rigid theories coming from membranes, and he found basically the structure for, one or two supercharges, and the structure of it looked like it came from 16 plus 16 supergravity. And he claimed that it didn't fall into the classification that had been done already for n equal 1. So maybe there's something new also for n equal 1 if you use a more general compensator. All right, thank you. Sorry, I ran a little bit long. All right.